along to another episode of Glow West, where we talk about sex, sexuality, and the body. I'm your host, Dr. Caroline West, and I'm here to shine a soft light on sex-related topics. I'm delighted to be part of the Tortoise Shack Network, where you can find podcasts on all sorts of societal and cultural topics. And if you wish to support us there, please do. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Today's guest is another multitasker with many, many strings to her bow. Camille Melissa Waring is a visual artist, creative director, and commercial photographer. She's currently a third-year PhD candidate at a prestigious Institute for Visual Research, and that's the Centre for Research and Education in Arts and Media at the University of Westminster. She holds an undergraduate degree in biological sciences, a graduate diploma in criminology, a master's degree in creative arts and digital photography. She has extensive experience working within the criminal justice system and as a full-service sex worker. Her recent work involves exploring issues related to photographic self-representation, body politics, sexuality, violence, feminism, surveillance, and censorship. Camille, thank you so much for joining me today. I hope you're well.
Good. Thanks for having me. And I always appreciate being stalked on Twitter. It's nice that I have a fan base.
Definitely. No, you post some amazing stuff. So, well, let's dive in. Tell me all about your PhD, the reason why I stalk you on Twitter.
Well, I hope you stalk me because I'm interesting.
Yeah, that too.
My PhD is technically in visual arts. It's called Hortography, Sex Workers as Image Makers, which is basically a critical analysis of the way the contemporary sex worker uses the self-image in online spaces. It's a bit of a mouthful. What does that mean? What do I mean by sex worker as image maker? Basically, I have an interest in the way the photograph, and when I say image, I specifically mean the self-portrait and portrait of women sex workers, including trans women. I have an interest in the way the photograph has become so integral to the sale of sex and what that means for the sex worker experience. I'm not necessarily looking at current sex worker theory or our understanding of lived experience of sex work to see how we can fit the image into that current dialogue. I'm starting with the image and working out, saying we need a better understanding of what's happening with the photograph to get a better understanding of what's happening with online sex work. And the thing about sex work and photography is that the photos are completely ignored. And if I can give you an example, there was a really interesting three-year study called Beyond the Gaze, I think it was in 2015 or 2016, that looked at the experience of online sex workers, and they did not have a visual aspect
Even though it's called Beyond the Gaze.
I found that exactly. And I found that really quite fascinating that, you know, sex has been sold online, I think, since 1994. I can't remember her name, but there was a stripper in 1996 who talked about on a forum how her photographs were being traded. So, you know, the photograph has been used to sell sex online since, for 25 years. It's been used to sell sex since, you know, the 1800s, well, pretty much since when photography sort of came into existence. You sort of get the porn industry and the prostitution industry just all converging in one spot. And there's a really pretty booklet from, I think it was the 1880s in Paris, called The Pretty Women of Paris, where they had beautiful photographs of the courtesans, and I use the quotation marks with that, next to a description, which is the precursor for the, you know, the modern online directory profile page. And what I find fascinating is it's so integral to the sale of sex, but no one talks about it. And I think no one talks about it because sex workers are falling to what we call known representations, because we assume we know about their lives because we have an idea of how they're represented. And they're always represented by others in cinema and art and media. And one thing that really surprised me is when I was finishing the MA, which was about, is it possible to reclaim the word whore through creative practice? And when I was putting together the application for the PhD and I was doing a literature review, I couldn't find any contemporary examples, except for maybe Annie Sprinkle in the 1970s, where she did a couple of pieces on self-representation. I couldn't find any literature on the way contemporary sex workers see themselves. And I was, you know, to be honest, really pissed me off, because we don't consider the sex worker someone who sees herself, she's someone who's represented by others. So there's all this academic literature about how others see her, not the way that she sees herself. And that's how my PhD came to be. I'm meant to be mapping the entire visual landscape.
Yeah, a big task.
As a woman sex worker. Just something minor in my spare time.
Well, it's such an interesting point, though, because sex work, if you think about it, you know, it's always just bogged down in ideology. It's like, is it good or is it bad? And, you know, we've discussed this before on the podcast, like the morality aspect. But that, if we just stay focused on that morality aspect, you don't get into those nitty gritty aspects of like the image or things like how much of a hustler a sex worker is nowadays, especially an online sex worker, and how, you know, you're managing websites, booking systems, you know, online payment services, like all these different aspects to it. It's literally just, is it good or bad to sell sex for money? And it's just, it's such a stunted discussion a lot of the time. And so I'm really glad that you're doing the work that you're doing.
Don't talk about photography. That we're so used to seeing the image that it just, people lose conscious of it because it's so obviously in our face, and they don't understand what photographic theory is, and they don't understand, well, what does it mean when a sex worker posts photographs online? And I do call, I mean, I coined the term sex worker's image maker, because, and I specifically say women because men just aren't, male, in particular male straight sex workers, they're not subject to the same harsh visual critique as what it means to be a woman in online spaces. You know, if you look at media representations of straight male sex workers, you know, they're lying on the bed, they're spreading sexual good vibes, you know, they're helping women to reclaim their sexuality, where the hooker in media is, you know, depraved or, you know, drug-addled or, you know, a happy hooker.
That's a really good point. I don't think I've ever seen an image of a male sex worker painted as someone who's on drugs or not. It is that like empowerment.
No, and in
aspect.
Fact, I tweeted out as a joke, I got so frustrated after reading the Julie Bindle article about black male sex workers who trick white women into paying for sex. So they don't know, the white women don't know they're paying for sex. These black men are so devious. And the photographs that they had with the article were these men lurking in the background. And I got so frustrated, I tweeted out, I said, I'll give someone £15,000 and fuck it, I'll throw in a blowjob if anyone can show me a media article of the white straight male escort looking victimised, because you can't find one. No, they exist for gay men. Gay men are depicted as victimised. And that's why I sort of like not including men in my research, because I probably get laughed out of academia if I'm trying to situate the straight male escort in a paper that's essentially about the oppression of women, which is a bit contentious. I do get a bit of flack for that, but, you know, suck it up. Yeah. They can fund my postdoctorate and I'll do it then. So what was your question? It's about why we use photos, right? I mean, it's just, you know, but what does the photo mean?
Yeah.
It's not just... I think the problem is that when sex workers post photographs, say on Twitter or Reddit or whatever, people just dismiss them as marketing images. And because they're dismissed as marketing images, it's then easy for the prohibitionists to come in and say, well, she's just performing for men. But it's so much more complex than that. There's so many more audiences they have to navigate, the intentions, the reasons. And you really have to do a stylistic analysis, really down to the nitty-gritty things like what the type of shoes they wear in the photo shoots, which speaks to notions of capitalist worth, whether they're face in or face out, because, you know, that is such a contentious and hotly debated argument in sex work. But it's not something that exists outside the sex work community. Sure, you have examples in art where, you know, the faces, you have headless bodies and stuff like that. And I'm not, you know, and you can be attracted to a body and that has nothing to do with the face. But we've moved past, I think the academic conversation has moved beyond, well, she's cut off her head, she's objectifying herself, she's turned herself into an object. It's so much more complex than that. And when you start looking at the reasons why, for instance, if I use the face in, face out conundrum, is that if you start looking at the reasons why, you can then start getting sex worker photographs redefined as new subgenres of portraiture, which would then get into academic spaces for the first time. a critique of the way sex workers see themselves that is devoid of outside influence. I mean, I'm not saying it's devoid of outside influences, but it's devoid of the way other people see themselves. And then from that, you can start having discussions about, is there such a thing as a sex worker gaze? I mean, I'm not too, you know, I don't like the term male and female gaze. Sorry, Laura. because I think it's too much about, it's more, it should be more to do about a cultural construct, not about a gender.
Yeah,
construct.
That's a fair point.
Yeah. But it's the way that, it's the sex workers turning the lens on themselves because they're just no longer performing for men and they're creating photos for themselves, which is more complicated in social media spaces because they can't control who's looking at the images. And if they can't control who's looking at the images, then they can't control how the images are being weaponized against them, which is also a big part of my research in looking at the way image-based violence that's perpetrated against women sex workers. And if you want to understand how women sex workers in online spaces are just disregarded, their practices to keep themselves anonymous are just completely disregarded. No one gives a shit about the online misogyny faced by sex workers. How come in all these discussions we have about revenge porn and all these legislations that we have coming up to tackle upskirting and creep shots, there's no bit of legislation that says, well, hang on, what's lens-based violence for the woman sex worker? Because it's just not about sharing sexualized images. It's about sharing, you know, non-work images to, you know, evoke reputational destruction. So why, when these sex buyers, when they're outing sex workers on Punter forums, and this happened to me, someone posted my photos on there, why isn't that a crime? Why can't I then go to the police and say, you know what, they've used that image as a tool of violence against me to cause me distress? But I can't do that because it's just dismissed as, you know, part of punting culture. So this is all the stuff that my research is trying to unpick. Yeah. And it's just,
and I think that's, it's very important, very timely now as we see the rise of things like OnlyFans and campsites, which are really changing, I suppose, the porn industry itself and, you know, how we think of sex work for a lot of people. But I've seen questions over, you know, sex workers that have had their content from OnlyFans taken off there and sold around, and that doesn't seem to be perceived as a crime as well. And, you know, yeah, there needs
no,
to be
it's got a lot to
that.
Do because of visibility, and you're being punished for having the audacity to be a whore in online spaces. And the argument is, well, it's victim blaming. It's, well, you put yourself out there. What did you expect? Yeah. Well, I expect my creative content not to be ripped off.
Yeah.
And further than that,
yeah.
And this is why we need, you know, and I've just about an hour ago finished a chapter on lens-based violence. What does that mean for the sex worker? And because we don't have these discussions, and if you follow enough threads on Twitter, you see this play out day in and day out. You see sex workers victimised time and time again, and the standard response is, well, what do you expect, putting erotic content online or non-erotic content? And I'm just like, my God.
Well, it's that double lens, you know, because like people who are victims of image-based sexual abuse, there is still that victim blaming of there of going, well, don't record so having sex. So when you add in then sex work on top of that, it's like that double punishment and double blame.
Well, she can't be shamed. If you're a whore, you can't be shamed. You're unshameable. And there's this whole insidious notion that, you know, being a prostitute means you're a public woman up for public consumption. All you have to do is see how people flock to Twitter to follow hooker accounts, and you know there's this something really off about the public fascination with otherness. And because you're so othered, then people don't care if you're violated, because it's self, you know, it's been brought on by yourself. And there's a really disturbing quote, let me try and find it, by a sex buyer who we were having a discussion about lens-based violence, and he turned around and said, I want them, the sex worker, to suffer social stigma, as it is the right of the majority to stigmatise any fringe abhorrent behaviour, period.
Wow.
And I was like, oh my God, what is that?
Yeah,
and I've got other
vigilante
comments,
kind of stuff.
Yeah, I've got other comments from sex buyers who, and the funny thing is they don't even think that they're doing anything wrong, which is why I think it needs to be you know, my research needs to cross into criminology and criminal justice fields, because you have sex buyers who are so socially, they've convinced themselves that they need, oh, they've convinced themselves that the photo is a currency of trust. How do I know she's authentic if I can't see 3,000 photographs? And if I can't see 3,000 photographs, she must be fake. If she uses stock photos, she must be fake. And what happens when she stops posting photographs? They get this such entitlement and thirst for knowledge that they will go out of their way to find any visual data they can because they feel entitled to it. And any sex buyer that says they don't do that is a goddamn liar, because it happens to every, because they feel like they, you know, oh, I've met this prostitute online. Who is she? Who is this bold woman that sells sex? And okay, she's concealing her face. And that is a real, you know, that whole blurring out your face, being facing, I totally respect and understand why people do that. But to a sex buyer, that's like a, you know, there are threads on sex buyer forums where they compete with each other about who can find someone's identity. So we have to, so we have to hold sex buyers accountable for the role they play in land space for arts.
But there's a huge power dynamic in that as well. Of like, the sex buyer generally likes to be anonymous as well, and would probably
Look at the way they construct themselves on Twitter. They will, you know, Twitter sex buyers, for instance, they think that they're there because they're sex work activists. Bullshit. They're there to create the illusion, to sell the idea that they're the gentleman client. And you see them with the stock photos of the black and white photograph of a celebrity, someone like John Malkovich, or, you know, the stock photos of a suit and tie. I'm a suave international businessman. But you know what? These fuckers are the first ones to critique sex workers when sex workers use stock photos to sell sex. Oh, well, she's a fake. She's using stock photos. Well, hang on. All industries use stock photos to sell sex, to sell anything. Why can't sex workers do it? Oh, no, no. For me to prove that she's trustworthy, she has 3,000 photos and they have to be current. Wow. Completely oblivious to the fact that they're using stock photos to sell themselves. And it's, you're right, it's this, that sex buyers have been allowed to remain anonymous in the transaction of sex. Even prohibitionists are allowed to remain anonymous. And it's the sex worker who's putting herself out there. And because she's, you know, Foucault, visibility is a trap. The problem with the internet is that, and for a while there, sex workers were really flourishing. You had, you know, the rise of, maybe in the 2000s, you had the rise of the independent escort online who was taking control of her visual facade and was really, and then you got social media come along and you got the rise of the celebrity whore, the social media whore, where they've got 20, 30, 40, 100,000 followers, and then along comes Sessa and Foster and it's like, shit. So we forgot who was looking at us in our quest to occupy space, which we're entitled to occupy space. Do you know, this is why Sessa and Foster exist, is to push us back to the dark alleys where, you know, we're meant to belong. It's why land-based violence against sex work isn't a crime, because their argument is, well, don't be a whore online, you know. You shouldn't have made the photo so traceable, and it's just ridiculous. And the amount of surveillance software that's... Sorry, go ahead.
No, you're right. No, I was just saying it's no, you're here to rant. That's the whole point of the podcast. That's fine. No, but it just really strikes me what you're saying there about... this, like, Foster and Sessa, obviously the American laws that are allegedly supposed to stop sex trafficking, and all they essentially do is stop consensual sex work, and haven't really produced a whole dent in the sex trafficking field. But what strikes me with what you're saying is that the voice of the sex worker themselves is really missing from a lot of this conversation. You've got the sex buyer who has a lot of power in that situation, and their safety over this anonymous sex worker is considered not sex workers' safety, and then the laws that are saying we're going to protect you from yourself, but while we're going to do that, we're going to silence you completely. And then you got the prohibitionists who want to silence the sex workers, and then you've got academics who talk on behalf of sex workers. So you're just like,
you know, you've got the whole argument. What makes me chuckle about the prohibitionist argument, oh well, she exists online, she's privileged, totally missed the digital revolution of the 1990s and the mobile phone revolution that took out what, you know, photography used to be considered a middle-brow art. So in the 60s and the 70s, the only people who had access to photography were wealthy middle-class people, and they controlled the visual narrative. of the peasants, and that's a technical term,
Yeah.
beneath them.
Very technical.
What these prohibitionists don't realise is, you know, the democratisation of photography changed all that. The internet changed all that. So, you know, the oppressed other can exist in the same spaces. But because they can't fathom that, because they still think photography is a middlebrow art, the best defence is to say, well, you're privileged, you're not, you know. And some of the sex workers I interview for my, you know, research, street-based sex workers, undocumented immigrants, young sex workers who show their face because they're trying to reclaim their face because there's, you know, there's child pornography online and they want to reclaim their image. So it's quite powerful stuff. And but that's, you know, that's just another way to silence sex workers, is called dismissive. And it's why I get so much flack about my research, is people really react vitriolically because they think I'm not using the right sex workers, and they don't understand my research field site is the internet. And when people ask me, where do you find all your sex workers, I'm like, Twitter, man, it's a red light district on the internet. It's like, what do you mean where I find them? Of course I'm going to find them on Twitter. Where else would they be? But what I really loved about Sestra and Foster, I mean, when people got over the initial panic, there was this beautiful creative resistance and creative destruction in response to trying to outwit the, you know, the patriarchy and the algorithms, and trying to outwit shadow bannings. And people started doing, you know, beautiful things with face coverings. And so they've essentially created a new whole, you know, visual, inadvertently, they've become visual activists, because in an effort to maintain their presence online, they're trying to beat the system. And if you look at what, you know, if you look at what a lot of the BDSM community is doing, is like, especially to try and beat the algorithms on Instagram, they're trying to, well, because Instagram will read a photo, well, that's a hooker photo, that's an Instagram influencer. So these sex workers have brought BDSM out of the dungeon and into brightly lit hotel rooms and started hashtagging them with, you know, women owned business, civilian hashtags, to sort of hide in plain sight. And I find that quite destructive, and it's a beautiful example of visual resistance, and
it's so creative. And we don't give sex workers enough credit for being.
No, you don't. But when you look at, and I look at a lot of photographs.
I can't imagine.
When you look at grand scales of images, you see beautiful rhythmic patterns or creative resistance, and it just makes my heart glow, because people are, sex workers aren't just walking away, they're not disappearing, they're responding creatively. And this is what my research is doing, trying to get an understanding of what they're doing, why they're doing it, and fitting it into some theory, and then pushing it out to the world and going, well, you know, why don't you ask sex workers about how they
I'd love to see, you mentioned stock photos earlier. I'd love to see a bank of, like, sex worker approved stock photos, because in the media, we were talking about academia there, but the media is really important, because like, every article I've written about sex workers or seen about sex workers, it's just like a pair of legs bending into a car, and then that's it. And it's like a lot of sex work doesn't look like that.
And even if the article's about indoor sex worker, I mean, in 2016, I took a stalker to court. And he turned out to be a Metropolitan police officer. So it was quite a scandal. It was all over the news. Geez. And, you know, they interviewed, was it The Guardian? They interviewed me, maybe. And then they ran an image, because I didn't want my photograph in the paper. In hindsight, I should have bloody just done it. But they ran an image of a pair of heels with fishnets walking along the road. And I'm like, oh, I fucking don't need a fishnet. So generic is the idea.
Yeah.
And it comes back to what I was saying before about known representations. Certain categories of people fit into known representations, therefore we don't have to change the representation, because we think we know what their lives are by the images that are, you know. And this crosses into so many complex narratives and situations that are happening now, the Black Lives, you know, Matter movement, the protesting, people not wanting to be photographed because of surveillance and all sorts of stuff. So there's some of these issues that just absolutely transgress all marginalised populations. But sex workers, I just find the sex work photography and the imagery so fascinating, because it's just so overlooked by academia. And I couldn't believe that I was the first academic to come along and go, well, how do they see themselves? I'm like, surely I can't be the first.
But
Oh my
I'm
God, I wonder what
sadly not surprised after like my PhD was 5 years, and it just so much of the work that's just really poor. And you know, and someone's probably going to come along and say that about mine, that's fine. But again, you know, but it's just there's just so much caught up in the politics, and it's like, right, life has moved on, you know, and sex work has moved on, and all those studies in the 70s
But
and
people's
80s are completely
attitudes
different.
don't. And those attitudes are fueled by the image. And I can give you a few examples. Like when I speak publicly, when I do conferences, my God, do they turn out to a shit show? Because they can't separate the politics and their emotional response to sex work to what I'm actually talking about, which is just dry and boring bullshit photographic and film theory, really. Do you know, I was giving a talk and the woman running the panel interrupted me and said, the panel host interrupted me and said, you know what, I really find the word whore offensive. I don't like the way you use the word whore. And I went off on this rant and said, well, if you find the word whore offensive, you must find the word wife offensive, because that's rooted in notions of patriarchal ownership. You know, you turn love into an object. Why can't we call sex, turn sex into an object? And then another woman at another conference got really offended that I was including trans women. I mean, why wouldn't I, for fuck's sake?
Yeah.
She went off rant at me about, you know, men occupying women's spaces, and then wanted to know why I wasn't going sitting in a community photographing them, because that's how you understand it. I've gone bullshit. And I said to her, you show me a photographer that goes in and photographs the community of sex workers, and I'll show you one who still doesn't know shit about sex workers, because I've never met a bloody photographer. You know what? I'm going to sell sex for 12 months to find out what it's like to be a sex worker, and then I'm going to go fucking photograph hookers, because you don't know what it's like to be a whore unless you are a whore. But the funniest example, I mean, it wasn't funny, it was actually quite threatening, and I lodged an official complaint against someone. This guy was so offended at the idea of I was using women sex workers online that he couldn't imagine that any woman in their right mind would label themselves as a whore. So he started calling them sex bots because they're fake, started calling me a sex bot, and then I said I was unethical. Like, he was literally jumping up and down, and he just
Oh
went
my
on for 20
God.
minutes. And me and him were in this sparring match because I had the audacity to ask online sex workers, how do you see themselves? And it's just a triggering point. And I don't know any other marginalized community where it's, and he, radical feminist, and I get more death threats from radical feminists than I do men.
So, because
But
it's so
he was
feminist to
arguing
threaten
about,
another woman.
you know, I know, it's different. You know, you should read some of the insults I get. It's quite hilarious. But he just couldn't wrap his head around that, A, these women were real, and any woman who's sexualized on the internet must be fake because it's a scam. And why would any woman put a photograph online and label herself as a whore? And I'm like, and to call them sex bots, I was like, my God.
Yeah, talk about
Yeah, so I,
objectifying there.
yeah,
But
so
like,
when I, and
I
go
have that
ahead.
experience as well. I've you know, and some of my I looked at interviewing women who worked in the porn industry, so I'd present on that, and then at the end, you know, because when you're at conferences, you know yourself, like you're usually the only sex person there. It's like everyone else is studying English or whatever. But
English
I.
literature and like
Yeah, and you're like the weirdo in the corner, like it's fine. But the questions on that, like I did a presentation before on feminist porn from San Francisco, and the answers were like, yeah, but that your meaning of consent here is meaningless to like people who are born into prostitution in India. And I was like, yes, that's the point. It is meaningless because they're two very, 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 very different things, and they're not
you
like
know, I
equatable.
spoke at Birkbeck University at a film conference, and I was talking about how to contextualize my research as sex makers and image makers in what we, you know, in visual representations of from cinema, going back to, you know, whenever there was a first cinematic representation. And I felt really bad because there was like three of us on the panel, and the questions are dominated about, to me, but they're about sex. They're not about photography. What do you think of sugar babying? You know, what do you think of trafficking? And I'm like, very rarely when I give talks do people just specifically ask me about sex workers as image
What you've
makers,
just
because they
spoken
can't,
about.
they've, you know, and this is going to sound harsh, but they lack the intellectual and emotional capacity to separate the photography and the photographic theory and the image and theories about identity and representation and presentation from the politics of a cunt. They cannot, absolutely cannot. When you say, and I'm out in academia, I'm out as a sex worker, and I'm very privileged in the fact that my university is very welcoming and accepting. No one gives a shit. I'm just as boring as everyone else. But I don't out myself in conferences because I think it's too much. And when I was giving a talk, this woman who was very anti-sex work, and I don't know why you would show up to a talk that says photography in the fucking title, she says to me, well, obviously you're not a prostitute. And I've gone, well, why wouldn't you assume a prostitute can exist in academic spaces? And she goes, well, you're this, you're that. And I'm like, oh, should I tell her? Because there's this whole idea that the prostitute is so other, so maligned, so lacking on autonomy. She needs these middle-class bitches. And I use the word bitches as misogynistically as I can because I'm just backhanding that back to them. Because these women can't think for themselves. Well, why else would they be a whore in an online space if they had other option.
But that's almost a double-edged sword, because if you did come out, then you'd just get dismissed as, oh, well, you're not representative of the everyday prostitute would be the word that they'd use rather than sex worker. So it's like, can you win?
No, you can't win. And I did have a really civilized debate with, admittedly, we were probably both drunk and high, with this radical feminist. Best time. We were a bit mallow. There might have been spot in there. And she said to me, it's really interesting that I say selling your body and you say selling a service. I've gone, with all due respect, I said, what do you radical feminists think, that glitter bombs explode out of your vagina when you have sex, that sex is so sacred and so holy that a woman loses a bit of, I'm like, piss off. Like, it's just difference than paying someone to get your hair done, get your nails done, you know. And it's just like, but it's this whole sex wars debate from the 70s and the 80s that is still lingering.
And it hasn't changed. And now, of course, much.
No, now it's all co-opted by, you know, religious nutter. That's not very polite, but I don't give a shit. Do you know, it's this, you know, really Americanized brand of white Western Christian fundamentalist that, you know, we need to rescue we need to rescue the natives from themselves. And what's really interesting is that if you look at media representations from 1990, in particular, if you look at Canada, the photographs in media reflected people's opinion of sex work. Oh, it's dirty, it's got to clean up the streets. So the streets, you know, the photographs were typically all street-based, big grotty. And then it shifted on to trafficking. So all the photographs now are about trafficking because that's what governments and these, you know, these people who raise all these lobbyists, anti-sex lobbyists, want to convince the public that it is. Hence, all the Eastern European girls who are walking around on the streets in, you know, because, oh my gosh, she's being trafficked. And if I go back to the thing about lens-based violence, if you look, and that is such a broad spectrum of behaviour. I think I've got about 15 things that constitute lens-based violence. If you look at what a platform like Adult Work does, they require sex workers to submit a proof of whore selfie. So when you register a profile, to prove that you're the person in the photos, because hookers are so distrustful, you've got to hold up a current photo with a code, with a newspaper, you know, and who the fuck buys newspapers anymore? And so I don't get sued, I'm going to say. some of my research subjects have told me when Eastern European, when they try to register on Adult Work, not only do they have to show the proof of whore, but they've got to go stand out in front of a street sign or a London landmark to prove that they're actually in the country, because Eastern Europeans are so perceived to be such dubious, insidious, deceptionist characters.
That's interesting.
That they have to get extra proof. Yeah, that is lens-based violence. And now, so Adult Work is sitting on this massive database of sex worker photos. What if they get hacked? What if they finally roll over like Eurus did and hand over all their information, you know, to Homeland Security, or we get a similar version of Sestra and Foster in the UK? You know, that's every sex worker is then subject to photographic scrutiny, which is not what happens with sex buyers. When they register on Adult Work, they don't have to register a photo.
Oh,
We're
okay.
not the ones killing ourselves. It's the men
Yeah.
bloody killing us, but they don't have to register. It's all the onus is all falls on the sex worker.
Surely, if they actually cared about their clients, they'd be wanting to create a system where the sex workers want to use their platform because it's a safe platform to use. So
No, and
therefore,
this is my critique of the industry and sex
yeah.
buyers, that sex workers always start in the position of distrust. Oh, there's a lot of dubious characters. How do I know? And now the photograph has been turned into a currency of trust by men with all these ridiculous arbitrary rules. Oh, well, you've got to have three or four photo shoots a year. That is so classist and that is so fucking sexist and racist. And I cannot even tell you how that sets up the class strata, the hierarchy of sex work, where they're, I mean, I even saw one Twitter company who they do the referee checks for sex workers in America. And they tweeted out, if she doesn't have a professional photo shoot, she's not legit. And I'm like, excuse me, what does that mean? So somewhere
They're
along the
like
line,
hundreds of dollars. Like that's not accessible to
no, they're
someone who maybe.
thousands. They're thousands. One sex
Wow.
worker was telling me she's had 36 professional photo shoots in the
Oh.
course of her. And I'm like, when did that happen? But what's really interesting, since Fester and Foster, because in the 2000s, you started to get professional escort photo shoots and, against a coloured backdrop. And then, you move on to social media and the selfie becomes a thing, and then you get the professional lifestyle photo shoots where they're all bent over a chair in a luxury hotel. But what's interesting, since Fester and Foster, and since there's been so many dubious accounts of photographers, and I won't name names, doing dodgy stuff with sex worker photos, that the community has really closed in on itself. So you're getting sex work collectives where they're working together to create creative content, or photographers with lived experience of sex work. So there's an inherent trust. So that's one of the positives, I think, is that you since Sessa and Fosse, you've seen this, the community closing ranks and bringing the creative production within the community. And hopefully in the next couple of years, the male escort photographer will be a thing of the bloody past.
Yeah, the guy with camera. Interesting area, shall we
Exactly. So,
say?
I mean, there's some positives and some negatives that happened out of Sessa and Foster. But you don't see it until you look at it. And then people don't look at it because they're too busy caught up in the politics.
Yeah. Well, like you said
It's
earlier, the
just a
people
shame.
who come to the conferences and they'll say something that isn't even related to what you just said. It's because they already have that opinion and they're literally just waiting for their opportunity to share that opinion, regardless of what you say completely. So when you're trying to be a sex worker and express your opinion, I'm sure that must be just the most infuriating thing.
I really have quite mixed experience feelings about it. Like, I mean, do you want to know how I came out in my PhD? I applied for a PhD, not thinking I was going to get in. Went into the interview where you give your hour and a half presentation and they challenge you on it. And I just put it on a slide. Oh, I'm going to use my lived experience as a photographer, artist, and sex worker, and just
Just throw that in
blended
there.
it out. Just throw that in there. And I think because I'm in an arts faculty, they didn't really have an issue with it. And then they rang me and they offered me the PhD and they said to me, are you comfortable being supervised by the guy who was on your interview panel? And this is a really high-end guy, professor of photography. He's like, he knows his shit. And I'm going, yeah, I don't have a problem with it. I'm going, do you have a problem with it, sort of thing? And I don't think I really thought about the consequences. I knew I'd get shit. I just didn't know I'd get flack so fast. And 6 months into the PhD, my first year, a guy rang up my graduate school and said, do you know Camille Waring? She's did a PhD there. Do you know that she's a prostitute? And
Oh my
the graduate school,
God.
like, yeah, we know, piss off,
Yes,
sort of
so
thing.
what? Like,
So what? And then the next day he
Jesus.
rings up, a bit miffed that they're not taking any action. That he rings up so emboldened by whore stigma that this idiot gives his real name, real identity, and says, oh, she's running a prostitute ring. I demand to know what building she's working in. So then they've caught me and panicked, and this has become a security risk now because he's trying to
This guy's
show up. And
obviously a
I've
bit
gone,
unhinged.
yeah, and I'm going, I'm a prostitute. tutoring. I'm doing a full-time PhD. Who's got the time to be a PIM,
right? Well, you are a multitasker, so.
I know. It's the extent people go to try and get you booted out of academic circles. That's where I think I'm incredibly lucky, privileged, bit arrogant and cocky that I just didn't give a shit, like everyone knows. And also I'm in my 40s, still in my 30s if you read my adult work profile, but I'm not, you know, you when you get into your 40s, you do generally get to an age as a woman where I go, I don't give a shit what you fucking think. I don't care.
Yeah, for sure.
But I've experienced worse cases of whorephobia. Before that, I lost a baby at 4 months, and then one of my friends emailed me and said my baby deserved to die because I was a prostitute. I was like, what the fuck?
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And people think, so you know, you go back to what – it is so heartless, but it's just this whole thing of being a prostitute. You're so dirty. You're so worthless. You're so nothing. And if I can give you a recent example, and I won't name names because he follows – I won't name names. But I have a friend who – and, you know, I assumed he was a good friend. And then he just drops a bombshell that he's written a book about sex work. You know, as an Oxford-educated man, he's written a book about sex work. And it's like, come again? And he goes, I want you to read it. And I got really, really upset. I said, well, why am I pissed that you know that I'm a prostitute and you didn't ask me? You've waited for it to be almost published, then asked for a sex worker's opinion. Your editors didn't hire a sensitivity editor to make sure everything was okay with the book. And I'm really disappointed and sad that you've written a book about my community and you didn't tell me. And he goes, well, what? And I said, why didn't you tell me? And he goes, well, I was a bit scared because it's provocative and out about an outsider writing about sex work. I'm like, yeah.
That's kind of the point.
And I was like, oh, my God. And it changed the dynamic of the friendship. Yeah, and it changed the dynamic of the friendship that you still there.
Oh, yeah, still here.
Oh, no. Yeah. It just changed things because I felt real. And my first question to him was, please tell me you have not written about the lived experience of sex workers because I'm going to be pissed. Because you see all these books written by men where they're not about the sex buyer's experience. They're not saying he's a sex buyer. They talk about the women that they've had sex with. I'm like, what the fuck is that? It's because the sex work is the most interesting thing. I think people are so fascinated with a woman who can stick two fingers up to convention and boldly be a whore that it then turns into – there's a fine line between fascination and disgust, right? And I think it's like when men hate wank about you, it's like, what the fuck are you doing? Like, it's just – and I think to exist online is – as a sex, and what worries me about this pandemic and in this rush to join OnlyFans, that if we go back to what we were talking about at the start, this thing on lens-based violence, and that shit is out there forever. But what's interesting is the language has changed around it. Oh, you know, I'm not an online sex worker, I'm an e-girl. Because yes, that's more palatable.
I've seen that now, and it's just that level of the hierarchy of, you know, sex workers looking down on other sex workers, because that's what stigma does. It's like, oh, I'm a sex worker, but I'm not one of those sex workers.
And what's really interesting, since the pandemic, there's two tiers that have been added to the hierarchy. The sex workers who are still doing full service sex work, who are absolutely getting shat on by those who can choose not to work. And I call them lifestyle sex workers, where it's an artistic expression, not in a financial imperative. And you can spot them. This pandemic really exposed it. And then you've got the, you know, the online girls who have transitioned to onto OnlyFans, and you see typical middle-class privileged women like Carolyn Carraway, whatever her name is.
Oh, yeah, the one who said she's the only educated woman on
OnlyFans. Yeah, cerebral. I'm like, Jesus, ridiculous. Fuck, woman, what the fuck are you doing? Like, yeah. Yeah. And it's this whole thing where you can be a whore. You can be whore-ish. You just can't be a whore. And then there's different types of acceptable whoreness. Like, I think I get away with being a whore because I'm doing a PhD and I'm in arts and, you know, that. You know, it's a bit bohemian, it's got a bit bourgeoisie. I spend a lot of time in Paris, all my friends are in literary circles, so it's almost accepted. It's almost, I'm white, I'm educated, except for my bank balance, I'm probably considered middle class, even though I was raised on benefits. So it's almost, you know, it's acceptable. And what's really interesting, when I changed my Twitter bio to put I can't remember what I had before, but I added the term feminist scholar or feminist political action. I stopped getting dick pics. I stopped people calling me a whore on the shit.
That's
like,
the
what
secret.
Is that? Yeah. But you know, that's to that, even to that extent, that's playing, you know, the class card.
Class is a really interesting conversation in sex work, and how it's weaponized by people in sex work as well to say, oh, I'm not like that, that's fine. But it's also weaponized outside of sex work as well by sex work prohibitionists, who are, again, they'll say people like you are, oh, you're not representative of the person on the streets or whatever. But it's also the people making that statement are middle class generally themselves, and they're like, either they're earning good money at a campaigning against sex work, so, but yet their class isn't important, but your class is.
That just blows my mind that I don't understand how you can be a feminist and actively platform for laws that make life more precarious for women, that lead to their death and financial destitution. And I'm like, how the hell do you sleep at night?
But that's what we've had in Ireland. Like, we have the Nordic model here, which has resulted in so many female sex workers being jailed and being charged as brothel keepers because they're working together for
and
safety.
And even then, I think since the 90s, it's been illegal to advertise sex. I'm pretty sure. So you don't have, you've had 25 years of, you know, internet sex being censored, which just makes it worse. Somebody was telling me about a really interesting case, you know, where, and this was in Ireland, where the site had labelled the woman's photographs as fake. So put a warning on her profile. Men, oh my gosh, she's fake. She's scamming us, which they weren't, by the way. They then lifted those photos and discussed them on the punting forum. Someone's then found out where she lives and went over to her house and threatened to kill her. That is an example of land-based violence. That is directly because of these laws about the Nordic model and restrictions on advertising. Then an example, if you go back in the state of Victoria, where this prohibitionist group were platforming for $300,000 in funding, they concocted this whole mythical photograph called the dead pose, where hookers pretend to lie dead on the in the bed, so it's more sexually appealing to men. They used that as an example to get funding to limit the way Victorian sex workers can photograph themselves in their advertising. I'm like, show me a fucking dead pose. Show me one photograph that is a dead pose and I'll shut the fuck up. And the difference between doing the MA and the PhD is, when I was doing the MA on, you know, a similar thing, people wouldn't take me seriously, like, piss off your MA student. Now I'm doing a PhD, probably, yeah. And then the privileged arguments come on, you're just privileged. I'm like, well, yeah, so privileged to pay my own university fees. It's just really quite
That's another fascinating power dynamic of saying sex workers, you can't represent yourself this way, whether or not it was true or in the first place or not. But that's like,
you can have Instagram influencers pretty much do anything. I mean, why hasn't Kim Kardashian been labeled a sex worker and had her Instagram banned? Because she's not a whore. You can behave like a whore online. You can behave like a whore in society. You just can't actually be a whore.
I've seen that with a lot of porn star accounts, and they get their accounts taken down, and they wouldn't necessarily have put anything explicit up or anything. Like, a lot of the stories are them going to the gym or just, you know, cleaning their house and shaking their ass when they're dancing or something, but their accounts get taken down. And again, yeah, if you're looking at things like the Kardashians and how overtly sexualized Kim Kardashian is and plays that game, but yeah, if you're an actual sex worker, you're not allowed
platform. Is, you know, the sex workers' product, so it can't work. Kim Kardashian is fucking selling a can of Coke or something. That's the line that people seem to go, well, that's okay. She's not selling herself, so, you know, that's okay. She can show her ass. But what's really also interesting that I found really fascinating since the pandemic is, so sex workers post a lot of erotic content, whether that's porn or erotic, that's another whole conversation, to attract men into a physical booking. So they post nude photos or tit shots or whatever they feel is suitable for their brand, to entice men into a physical booking. Since the pandemic and since men stopped paying for sex, sex workers suddenly realise, well, shit, I've got to monetise those photos. So I need to put them behind a paywall, OnlyFans. And then the photographs that they're posting on Twitter are so much more wholesome and sweet to entice them to now monetize, to get them to pay for something that they got for free before. And I find now I'm like, oh, yes. Get That's these fuckers to pay for the visual content that they expect, expect for free.
That's fascinating. Where do you see the future of sex work photos going? Are we still going to be, disembodied heads or legs floating around?
In media, probably. Yeah, I'm not, I have no faith in society. I don't think people are capable of change because they're so embedded.
Okay, don't hold back there. it's all doom and gloom, that's it.
Well, being a pessimist, how doing myself a PhD. No, I don't think people are that capable of change because, and I say this, they will platform against the abolishment of the sex trade because of patriarchal capitalism, but they won't platform against the abolishment of marriage and its patriarchal capitalist institute. So I don't think people are capable of that level of, especially around sex and sexuality and love and intimacy, desire. Do you know the whole phrase where, no little girl dreams of being a prostitute? You're right, because we're too busy socially conditioning little girls to be brides. I think that paradigm is so embedded in culture that I don't think it will ever change. And there was a journalist who got lambasted, and by rightly so, he got roasted on Twitter because he posted photos of the protesters from America. And everyone's like, can you not post these photos because of the surveillance? And he doubled down and said, no, fuck you, this is what we do in the media. And I posted this polite comment saying, well, you need to be mindful of state surveillance and the media's responsibility to the way their photographs are perceived and marginalised community. And left it at that, my God, did I get hammered, saying I'm tackling the media, I'm being unfair. And then someone wrote, are you suggesting that photojournalism is racist? I'm like, well, yeah, it is. But I think people, the whole thing with the media, I don't think they'll ever change because it's what we do. This is what we do. This is how we document certain types of people. And maybe hopefully when I put my research out there, other people will come along and build on it that will eventually get the change that we want. But, I became an adult in the 1990s, and I remember thinking in the 90s, my God, things are going to be so much better in 20 years, empowerment, we're all going to get there. And I think it's worse now for women than what it was in the 90s. Mm. So I'm not, I hope my research can make a change. I hope it can make a difference. But Jesus, we have some fucked up attitudes around sex and bodies and, love and holiness and worth and, the whole conversation, you see the conversations are, no one will want to marry you because you're a prostitute. I'm like, you say that. I have I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
I have three feminist goals: to change my title through education, not through marriage, not to ever want to be called a wife, and not to be killed by some bloke. That's all I ask for. But I hope that one day sex work will be just seen as work and just another boring job that everyone else does. I hope that in 5 years' time, sex workers are still going to exist in online spaces. I think they will. I think the visual ecology is going to massively change in response to the censorship and the algorithm. It's like, the Red Queen hypothesis where she's running on the same spot but not getting anywhere. That's what I think is going to happen. But do I think people are ever going to accept prostitutes? No, not at all. Too busy, selling themselves out to patriarchy through marriage. And what's interesting, all these sex buyers, most of them are married. So they're buying into, they're setting, you can't have a prostitute who's worthless, not unless there's women who are wives who are more valued. So whilst these men might claim, I'm a sex work activist, it's like, well, no bullshit, mate, you've just bought into the, that whole, complex
paradigm. Area.
Yeah,
there's a long way to go for sure, but that's people like yourself coming forward and contributing to the conversation and speaking up with actual lived experience rather than someone who doesn't.
Yeah, so it's just because I got pissed off. Rage is a very good political motivator, very good. And I like to think that I can make a difference, but it's just pure rage. It is frustration and anger that is just, and I locate myself heavily in the research, and autoethnography is, it's a feminist research tool from, you know, it's been years since, you know, really the 70s and the 80s. It's just, you know, I just hope that after I go through with all this research about, you know, sex workers as image makers, that we can finally have research about sex work photography. Because you know what, how long has sex work theory been around? Since the 70s? When did Carol Lee turn the coin sex work, sex worker? Maybe one paper before, you know, it's about bloody time that we can get in academia sex worker photography labeled as separate genres, legitimate genres of photography, of portraiture, that are unique to this marginalised group of people but valid nonetheless, that has important ramifications for the way that they exist in online spaces. And what's really telling is when I give talks to these people, you know, civilians, and I talk about censorship and I talk about algorithms, and they're so shocked, they don't know this is happening. I'm like, that's because you're not othered. You need to experience the internet from the perspective of the sex worker and then come back to me and tell me you know about oppression.
Absolutely. Well, hopefully our chat today will get them started in the right direction. Anyway, Camille, you're amazing.
I sound very Australian when I get passionate.
You do. The accent's coming through a lot more as well. So fascinating. Camille, where can people find you if they want to carry on the conversation? Because you're just, I think you're creating really important dialogue, and I think that needs to continue as much as possible. So you're quite active on Twitter. What's your Twitter for where people can find you?
Yeah, because it's my part of my research methodology. That's my excuse. You can find me at PhD Photographer on Twitter. And I also have a website called The Photographic Theorist, and I'm currently working with a graphic designer, so if anyone wants to drop some money into my funding pot to rebrand that as an academic space. Because one of the things, I mean, there's a couple of things I want to do post-PhD. You know, I mean, I don't want to graduate during the depression, but they may happen. One thing I do now is that I do mentor women with lived experience who are coming up in their masters and their PhD. But one of the things I really want to do post-PhD is set up a peer review journal specifically for researchers with lived experience.
That'd be incredible.
So that whole rebranding is kind of about that. And on the website, I do talk about men that I have sex with, but I also always put it in the context of photography. But I also talk about what it's like to be an academic in, you know, a sex worker in academia, because it's not always fun. But it's worthwhile, the challenge, but it's not
definitely
always good.
Well, you're creating great conversations about it anyway. So listen, thank you so, so much for talking to me today. And again, like all the podcasts, this could go on for 3 hours, you know, easily. But thank you so much. Fantastic.
That was good. That was fun. Thank you. Excellent.
Thank you. And thank you so much to all my listeners today. I really appreciate you tuning in. If you want to follow me on social media, it's Glow West Podcast over on Instagram and iTunes. Again, if you wish to support us via Patreon, we'd be always super grateful for that. And that's Tortoise Shack. So it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. And I look forward to chatting to you next week.